Hare Krishna. Any more introductions still outstanding? Yes.
Hare Krishna, would like to welcome everyone today. I'm glad you've come. The question we get often in our preaching is, what is wrong with the traditional religions like Christianity, etc.? So, today's speaker, Devaratha Prabhu, was born and raised as the son of a Christian minister for 20 years. But he found himself being led into temptation and going astray from time to time. So when he left home, he travelled around the world, looking for excitement and pleasure in different activities, until he finally met the devotees of the Krishna Conscious Movement about 12 years ago. And here he could see that spiritual life didn't have to be a matter of self-denial and an unpleasant affair, but there was some tangible spiritual happiness to be had. And he became immediately attracted, and for the last 12 years he's been engaged in spreading Krishna consciousness all around the world.
Thank you. Yes.
He was very relaxed.
Yeah.
Very natural.
Natural, yes.
Nice smile.
Maharaj, nice smile that counts.
Very interesting presentation. In other words, the fact that he was a Methodist minister. Did he mention the title?
He didn't, but that's not doesn't always have to have a formal title.
That really caught me that he was a Methodist minister. Now, if he said that he was going to speak on comparative religions, it would have been more effective. I felt it was extremely interesting. I just wanted the title.
Actually, I meant to give one, but in the spur of the moment.
Like I said, you may wonder what's wrong with today's religions.
That was very good. The way the subject, the opening subject of his talk tied right in to the person that he was talking about.
That, he didn't actually say he was going to speak on it.
But he didn't say he was going to speak on it. So that might have made it still more effective.
I'd say also it would be a good example for us of what a powerful opening to do. It was so interesting, it just kept our ears. And that's why I was just going to hear the title. Because the opening was just so interesting.
Good. Okay, anything more?
Liked it, and I was perhaps a little sorry I didn't hear much about the devotee's type, Devaratha as a devotee.
As a devotee.
I could also, but perhaps we're at the end and around the world. It's preached all around the world. It's pretty vague.
Yeah. A couple of facts there. Around the world, everyone preaches around the world these days, and from, they've been devotees for many years. But if we could get a fact that he's been preaching, Devaratha, where's Devaratha? Devaratha Prabhu, where have you been preaching?
For the last 9 years in New York.
Wow. That's around the world.
I won't make any partial statements, or that'll be the rest of the class.
All around the world.
That one fact that he's preaching in New York means a lot more than preaching all over the world, doesn't it? No one had any strong feelings about all over the world. New York does something to you. Yes?
The only funny note, I thought maybe some would be offended by his one-line dismissal of other religions as perhaps being a life of self-denial.
I didn't pick up on it, but okay. That could be noted. All right?
That was his personal experience. That wasn't actually knocking the religions. It was his knocking
the... He felt it that way. Okay. Anybody else still to speak? Yes, Devaratha Prabhu.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank you for coming to our Hare Krishna temple this evening. Tonight we have a special guest speaker from Australia, His Grace Gita Gurisha Prabhu. tonight's subject matter will be on the Varnashram institution and the establishment of Varnashram institution in society today. Jita Girish Prabhu has a very avid interest in this, which he has proven. In our ISKCON society, we are interested in establishing this Varnashram system by way of establishing self-sufficient, complete social units in our farming projects around the world. So Jita Girish Prabhu has, in the beginning of his career, his devotional career, he's 13 years a disciple of his Divine Grace, E.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. For his first 5 years, he was pioneering the farming project in New Zealand, and which was followed by 4 years as a managerial, managing a farm project in Australia. And presently today, he is on the managing council of their farming project also in Australia. So, having this ardent desire to see Varnashram system established in not only in our society but in the world today to ensure not only the material well-being of everyone but also the spiritual success, the progressive spiritual advancement of everyone in society. We feel that Jiti Girish is very qualified to speak on such a matter today.
Thank you. Comments?
I'm going to pause after he said what the title of the lecture was, which made it sound extremely profound.
We talked about that. Pausing, just letting things sink in at the right time. Good observation, also.
We didn't know what was the punishment.
Okay. You might want to consider whether Varnashram Dharma was a familiar enough term or whether it needed to be explained for the particular audience to which we're speaking. Yes?
I don't get any clear picture when I hear the word managing. Managing, for some reason, maybe it's
managing a farm community.
But if you've worked the oxen or something kind of specific.
I got the idea that Nenny was in charge. I think that's personal. Yes.
A little louder back here. I'm struggling with it.
Yes. Even over here, it could have been louder. I felt, maybe I'll stick my 2 cents in here. You speak well, and you have in mind what you're going to say. I think you can speak more confidently. Don't worry. Many devotees, I noticed that. You are competent. You do have something to say. You do know how to say it. And trust in that. Trust in that. Speak out loud and take the necessary time to put your sentence together or your next thought together. After you've said something, you don't have to worry that if you spend a moment or 2 moments or 3 moments collecting your next thought, the audience is going to feel that you're a dope. Rather, they'll probably get the impression that you're thoughtful. Or that you just said something important and you want to let it sink in. So, take a few extra seconds. Let your sentence fall into your mind more or less in its completeness, what you want to start out by saying, where you want to end up, and what's in the middle, at least for the next sentence or so. Then you don't have to pause and sort of search in the middle of a sentence. If you pause and search between sentences, it's not so disturbing. But if you're in the middle of a sentence, Jita Girish is then it's disturbing, because it seems that you don't really know what you want to say about it. But if you pause between sentences, between thoughts, it gives you a chance to really have it organized, and then to say it loudly, clearly, and with confidence that you know where that sentence is going to go, that when you start down the road, you know where you're going to end up at the end of it. Does that sound like it's to the point? Okay. Good. Everyone here can speak very well. Either you already are speaking very well, or you have the capability to speak quite well. And you just have to develop in it. Develop it. And a lot has to do with just trusting your capabilities and speaking out confidently. Anyone else who hasn't spoken yet? You want to speak tomorrow, Vasudev? Okay. Good. Follow up to yesterday's comments about the Srimad Bhagavatam class concerns today's Bhagavad Gita class. That is the subject of today, the Bhagavad Gita class. It used to be the standard all over our society that every evening all the devotees would attend the Bhagavad Gita class, the whole temple. That was our standard, morning and evening program, regularly. It sometimes used to be known affectionately as the ISKCON sandwich. You'd have program in the morning, program in the evening, and different kinds of work, occupational duties during the day. That was our standard. And if you went to any ISKCON temple, you'd find that being followed. Temple would be full for the evening aarti, and then it would be full for the class also. And it was a great refreshment and a great source of knowledge for our devotees. That gradually went out of style, or has gone largely out of style. That's due to various things. Partly it's due to our book distribution, because Srila Prabhupada said that for preaching, for Sankirtan, one could skip the evening program. That was more important to preach. So some of our devotees would stay out late in the evening and preach, and they'd miss the class. But now we find that that's no longer the reason. In fact, very few of our devotees are going out in the evenings and preaching at all. They're not out there distributing books or holding programs. What are they doing? Doing business. Either they're doing temple business, they're in an office somewhere, or they're doing business. They're out collecting money by selling things, which is a Krishna conscious thing to do. We're all in favor of raising funds, and we're in favor of business. We encourage, if you're a businessman, do your business for Krishna, give the money to Krishna. We have nothing against business. But time for devotees to do business during the day. Quote, "This is the duty of all my disciples, whether they are big or they are small. Actually, in our movement, there's no such thing as big or small. Everyone is a devotee. So everyone is expected to follow the devotional practices. Here in Vrindavan, I am enjoying my disciples, how they are speaking. So two times daily, everyone must attend the classes. During the morning and evening times, there should be no business. Simply kirtan, chant, dance, and be purified. Do not be paramhansa, that now I haven't got to hear Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Don't be a better paramhansa than your Guru Maharaj. I go and sit and I enjoy the lectures and how they are performing kirtan. So as I am doing, you must also do." That's to the president of the New York Temple. That is our standard. That is our standard. You can observe it yourself, and you can see whether the people who are presenting themselves as leaders of the Krishna consciousness movement on a higher or lower level are following this standard. If they're not, you can wonder.
If they're not,
you can wonder, why not? And you might even ask them. This is our standard. It should be reinstituted, revived, reemphasized. This is the standard. We do have a standard. And this is the standard set by the founder Acharya of this institution. And because we're not following the standard, so many unfortunate results are there. We get our knowledge from Bhagavad Gita, the basic principles of Krishna consciousness, the basic philosophy that keeps us together, comes from the Bhagavad Gita. And if we don't read it, what's it going to be replaced by? It's going to be replaced by Maya. We're going to become philosophically weak, then we're going to become weak in terms of sense control, weak in what we're able to do in terms of practical service, and finally, either just causing trouble in the society or leaving the society altogether. That's the result of neglecting. Srila Prabhupada, another quotation relevant to this is, if there's any difficulty in our institution, it is because of neglecting the orders of the spiritual master. Prabhupada didn't write this letter for nothing. So we're trying in this institute to encourage this principle to be followed. We realize that we've made it very difficult for you by a heavy schedule of classes and homework. And we're discussing how to adjust the next semester so that it will be easier for the students to attend religiously the Bhagavad Gita class. So you should figure out, we're figuring it out for here, for our own program, and try to figure out for your program, wherever you are, how to follow this principle and encourage the other devotees to follow the same principle. You'll feel great strength, you'll feel great enlivenment, you'll advance in Krishna consciousness, you'll be following Srila Prabhupada's instructions. Any questions?
Is there any point in sitting in the temple room by yourself and doing a Bhagavad Gita class?
Yes, there is a point. You'll be purified. The deities will like it. Srila Prabhupada will be pleased. And Srila Prabhupada said, the four walls will hear you. The spiders in the walls will hear you, even if no one comes. Even if no one comes, certainly there's benefit. And after a while, some of the others may think, what's that crazy guy doing sitting in the temple talking to the four walls, Bhagavad Gita? And they might even ask you. Then they might think, well, let me be crazy like that too.
Also, if you're just talking to the four walls, it won't be for long, because a lot of people are discouraged by our not holding regular Bhagavad Gita classes. Because if it's held regularly, then...
They will come. And if they don't, it's great practice in speaking. You won't get any tough audience giving you hard feedback. Preach as heavily as you want. Preach boldly to the four walls. It's fantastic. Try out your stuff. Sure. Any other points, questions?
If by Sankirtan devotees
you mean devotees who are preaching, who are distributing books, who are chanting the holy name of the Lord, who are going to people's homes and doing programs, let them go out full force and preach. Let them go out full force and preach. Home engagement means you'll speak Bhagavad Gita. Book distribution means Bhagavad Gita must be there. And Harinam, that's none different from Bhagavad Gita. But business, this is the source. It's another kind of fallacious argument where you take a word that has a meaning, like Sankirtan. As Bhakti Charumaj pointed out, it means congregational glorification of the Supreme Lord. And because Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur certified book distribution as the Brihat Mridanga, we accept book distribution to also be Sankirtan, or glorification of the Lord. Srila Prabhupada said it's chanting and writing. But when you take this word and get it to mean business, then the word has lost its meaning. As we pointed out at the beginning of our diction discussions, Krishna says, the words that we use to distinguish one thing from another are only representations of me. So if your words no longer distinguish one thing from another, they've lost their utility. If your word table doesn't distinguish it from a chair, what's the use of table? So if this word loses its meaning, if it just becomes anything that you do for Krishna, which is also a meaning of the word, but it's the broadest meaning. And if you use that broad meaning, where Prabhupada had a very specific meaning in mind, then you come out with nonsense. In the evening, there should be no business, only kirtan. But then when you change the word of this meaning of this word, you're doing exactly what Prabhupada said not to do, business, and you're not doing what he said to do, kirtan, but because you've changed the meaning of the word, you're doing the opposite and thinking that you're doing exactly what he said. Yeah, I'm doing kirtan. It comes out, it's double think. Having two incompatible ideas in mind simultaneously and thinking that they're both true.
Temple managers say that by selling Tantra, we raise funds, and factually, not just theoretically, but factually, we purchase very books from the PBT, which we distribute, so it's no different from preaching.
Everything's non-different from preaching. Eating's non-different from preaching, because by eating, you get the strength to go out and distribute books. So eating is also sankirtan. Paying the bills is also sankirtan.
But this is direct. Because
everything's direct. When you maintain that building, when you're talking on the phone to the lawyers so that we can open up our sankirtan spots, when you're talking on the phone to the lawyers to keep our building, or to, when you're talking to someone about the rent, or when you're doing anything for the service of the sankirtan movement, it's also sankirtan. But then what in the world does Prabhupada mean when he says no business? That business is all for Krishna. It's all for sankirtan. But if you just take that meaning of the word, then what Prabhupada said no longer applies to anything. Because you can do anything else for Krishna except to attend the Bhagavad Gita class and say, well, it's all sankirtan, Prabhu. My ultimate answer to that is that when householders in Krishna consciousness have sex for Krishna to raise a Krishna conscious child, that child is going to preach. And therefore what those householders are doing is sex sankirtan. Is that all right? That's called reductio ad absurdum. You just reduce the point to its ultimate absurdity. Everything you do for Krishna is sankirtan, so sex for Krishna is also sankirtan. So why should I go to the Bhagavad Gita class? I can do other things. I don't buy it. It has its utility to a point. Yes, when you do something for Krishna that urgently needs to be done, that's also Bhagavad Gita. But when it reaches the point where the Bhagavad Gita class is extinct like the dinosaurs, because everybody's doing something else for Krishna, and Prabhupada's instructions are lost, something is wrong. So let's go back to the standard that Prabhupada had in mind. Prabhupada used to say Bhagavatam in the morning and banking in the afternoon. So let's do that. Bhagavad Gita in the evening, Bhagavatam in the morning, and banking and all this other preaching and service in the afternoon.
Maharaj, there's also a concept of sankirtan, which is maybe a little more difficult to differentiate. In England, I know they're collecting funds on the street and then giving out books, one book per every...
I'm not going to go deep into that. I'm talking about specifically in relation to the Bhagavad Gita class.
But they're also encouraged not to...
I simply don't want to enter that area of discussion right now. But my point is that other forms of activity should not replace the Bhagavad Gita class. We should go to it. That is my point. Anything else?
Yeah, before we... Australia, we have at least four marathons a year, and during the marathons is my program of service.
Right. You can discuss it with your leaders there. There are a couple, they've had a couple problems in Australia, I've heard. So you can discuss with your leaders and see what you think.
Well, I know what that
is. Okay, I know what I think too.
So I'm going to the program.
Last question, by the way. Yes.
Then I have my servants during the day.
Right.
The evening happens to be the only time where there's a number of things I can do, such as writing, preaching, or writing to a godbrother, doing some necessary, important...
Find another time.
Well, I'm busy in the day.
You're busy in the night, too. You're attending the Bhagavad Gita class.
So those things I just can't do.
Okay. Readjust your life. Eat less, Prabhupada used to say. Get up earlier. Take rest at 8:30, right after the Bhagavad Gita class, and get up at 2:30 in the morning. If you're serious, we used to follow the same program. And we got tons done. Why? Because you save so much time, you become purified, and you don't have to deal with all this mess that results from not following Prabhupada's instructions. Your life becomes easy. Your mind becomes clear. You become philosophical. Come to the mode of goodness, you're peaceful, save yourself from getting married if you're a brahmachari, save yourself 25 years of your life.
So the Prabhupada's example here in Vrindavan, every evening, even towards the end, not the very end, he would come and sit, he was too sick, he'd have kirtan and he'd listen to somebody speak. And also, we know he was doing so much business. And then we also...
And writing letters.
Writing letters. And we know that in his spare time, in I think 18 months, he translated...
Chaitanya Charitamrita. This is Prabhupada's example. This is where our energy comes from to do all those things. Factually, if we follow these principles, we'll get more time. Be assured. We'll get more time, not less. Attend the Bhagavatam class, attend the Bhagavad Gita class, Krishna will give you the time. Be assured. We've saved so much time, we've saved so much money by neglecting Prabhupada's instructions, and see where it has gotten us. That was the last question. I was serious. If there's more time in the end, I'll take further comments. Diction. Quick. Puja, not pooj. I'm told pooj has another meaning. Puja, not Vyas pooj, not Guru pooj, puja. Another thing, it's not Brahma Sanghita. Brahma Sanghita. It's not the only Sanghita either. There's lots of Sanghitas, they're famous. And they're not Sanghitas. Okay? Next one.
Is it Sanghita?
Sanghita. Learn the system. Diacritic marks. To be Sanghita would have to have a long I. It doesn't. Sanatan Dharma. No. Long A. Sanatan. Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. Not Sanatan. Now there's another curiosity. In Bengal, there's a very charming feature of pronunciation that they say this, K-S-H, more or less like this, double K. You may have noticed Bhakti Charumaraj in his charming Bengali accent, speaking of Dikka. Shikha Guru and Dikka Guru. Kind of like KKH. But it's not like KSH. They don't say Daksha, Lakshmi, Diksha. It's like Lakmi. Right? Lucky. Similarly, they say Parikit. Maharaj Parikit. So you can also use these Bengali pronunciations if you want, but then we would suggest that you be consistent. We all say Daksha, we all say Diksha, we all say Shiksha, and we all say Prikkit. I know the reason why. So, I suggest you be bold. Go right ahead and say Maharaj Parikshit. Either one's okay, but if you're following Prabhupada's pronunciation, then be Bengali all the way. Otherwise, fearlessly say Maharaj Parikshit. That's right. Okay, one last one, very important. Since we're talking about Sankirtan, it's not Sankirtan. And it's not Sankirtan. It's Sankirtan. That's the only place the accent goes, right in the middle. And since we're the Sankirtan movement, let's get it straight.
If I say one of the world, which everyone goes wrong all the time,
yes.
Everyone sings
or
says, Srimati
Bhaktivedanta Swami. Srimate. Srimati means Mrs. Good, that's worthwhile. Srimati means Mrs. Srimati and Indira Gandhi. I'm going to end. We'll take some more tomorrow, maybe, because I want to get to the next topic. Save them up, either English or Sanskrit mispronunciations. Save them up, write them down. We'll teach them next semester, and we'll add them this semester. Ad hominem, were there any questions? I think we got it down. Straw man. Big, big, big fallacy in ISKCON. Attacking straw man. The straw man argument consists of hearing your opposer's argument, extending it, or twisting it, or misrepresenting it, and then attacking your twisted or misrepresented version. Then naturally, because you've set it up that way, you smash it, you pulverize it, you completely wipe it out. But you haven't done a thing to the man's argument. It's like shadow boxing, you know, a lot of energy, but you didn't defeat anybody. Don't attack straw men. Here's a typical one. Did I quote it there? Sometimes the argument is put forward that good relations between devotees is not possible until we become completely free from sense gratification. Whoever put forward that argument? Nobody. No one's ever argued that we have to become completely free from sense gratification before we could have good relations with devotees. But because I want to smash that idea and prove that the opposite is true, I represent it this way. Okay? That's because the person's not there in person to defend himself. Maybe we think we can get away with it. But suppose it was like this. Suppose the opposer is really there. You're saying we can't have good relations until we become completely free from sense gratification. But that's a cop-out. Does it mean until we become pure devotees, we have to fight like cats and dogs? That's ridiculous. Improving the relationships between devotees has to come first. That's the argument. And what's the answer? Then the person says, well, I'm afraid you've misunderstood me. Being completely free from sense gratification is another question. My point was simply that the more we give up sense gratification, the more our relationships with one another will improve. So really we ought to get more serious about controlling our senses. But that's a harder argument to deal with. And that's the real argument. But rather than deal with that argument, we just move it a little bit to the side, make a little shadow, and start punching. That's the straw man. Let's see if I have more to say about that. Here's another one. Just to give another example. You're saying that once one becomes a guru, he should be free to do just anything and everything he wants. But it seems to me, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, is there anyone who's going to argue that a guru should be just free to do anything and everything he wants? No. That's what you do in a straw man argument. You take the most absurd or horrendous, despicable kind of position. And that's what you make out of your opposer's decent, reasonable argument. And you figure that you've won. And maybe you will win if your audience is slow.
What was that distortion of?
Which one?
The guru should be free to
do whatever they do. Oh, I don't know. That gurus should be allowed to initiate all over the world. Rupa Goswami said, Prithivim Sasishat, gurus should be allowed to initiate all over the world. Why some zonal restriction? Well, you're just saying now a guru should just be able to do anything and everything without any restrictions at all. How can you live without restrictions? That's like against our philosophy. It's completely against Krishna consciousness. Right? I just take what you said, bend it a little bit, attack the bent version, and you're left standing there.
How do you counterattack that?
How do you counterattack it? Yes?
You just explained you got me wrong.
Sorry, you just attacked a straw man. That's not what I said. Pardon me, I think you've misunderstood what I said. I completely agree with that, but let me say what my position actually was. I don't think you heard me. Are we talking about the same thing? In that way. Yes?
So you're saying that the straw man argument is that a person is presenting some incredible fact or incredible statement, he's saying something that's not, that no one would accept, that you're trying to argue that.
Straw man means when you take an argument that's given and you distort it and attack the distorted version instead of the real version.
Attack the one argument?
Excuse me?
You said you take an argument that's given, attack that.
I give you an argument. You want to defeat me. Rather than speaking to the argument I gave, first you distort it and then you attack the distorted version. I said a guru should be free to go all over the world. And you say, well, I don't see how a guru can just be free to do anything and everything. But that's not what I said, was it? I said he should be free to travel all over the world. So you just took what I said, and rather than addressing the question, you address almost the question. That's the straw man. It wasn't the real man. I'm the real man, and you haven't answered me. You answered a straw man that you made yourself. And you knocked him down. And now you think you won. But if your audience is intelligent, they'll see exactly what you did. And if I'm intelligent, I'll see what you did too, and I won't let you get away with it.
Does any English-speaking person understand the expression straw man?
Not every English-speaking person, but it's the common term. Straw man argument is famous. You're attacking a straw man. And if the person doesn't know what you mean, explain it. That wasn't my argument at all. You just knocked down a straw man. You didn't knock me down.
Right. I'm just interested to know whether that's the same tactic that's used in politics. I know in the recent election,
yes, it is,
that the conservatives were really attacking the loony leftists, as they call them, as if they were representative.
Exactly. This is typical. Given any position that's mentioned, any position, no matter how radical, you'll find someone who's prepared to defend it. So I take a spectrum. Say there's 40 people who think that reform is needed in our daily sadhana. So I choose the guy who says, absolutely, without exception, every single person must attend the Bhagavad Gita every single day, regardless of anything. And although there's some, he's one person, and the other 10 say that unless you're out preaching, you should attend. Or unless you're under normal circumstances, you should attend. Or as a principal, you should attend. Rather than addressing all those reasonable, decent people who have got something important to say, I find that one loony guy, and I say, just see. This is, the pendulum swings from one end to the other end. You know? Now I can't even go to the bathroom. I have to attend the Bhagavad Gita class under every circumstance. You know, and all those people who have got something reasonable to say are dismissed in one wave of the hand.
I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur said something that the party politics is the
enemy of progress.
I was just thinking that, like, just like in the recent developments of our society, there's actually agreement in a great area, but it was always like reform looking at the most radical position or someone who is, you know, one man.
I could even attack that as a straw man argument also, or as an overgeneralization. It was always these people looking at those people. It was always this. It was always that. Maybe.
I don't hold that position.
Okay.
But it was happening to some degree. It seemed to be some
contamination.
Yes. Well, that type of...
it's sloppy thinking, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about sloppy thinking. Sloppy thinking, sloppy conclusion. When you take seriously the straw man argument, it means your brain is dull. If someone attacks a position that was never made, and you get real serious about the attack and say, yeah, he's got a point there, it means your thinking is dull or unrefined, not sharp. Critically think, what was his argument? Does this point answer that argument? If not, wait a second. You're not answering that man's point. What you say may be true, but what about his point? It's a form of avoiding the question. Don't put up with it. And don't indulge in it. If a position is too easy to attack, be suspicious of it. It's probably a distortion of a reasonable position. Right? Same example. You're just saying a guru should be free to do anything and everything. It's real easy to attack that position.
Under what circumstances might you come up with, if someone's saying that position, if someone's saying that...
If someone really says it, that a guru should be absolutely able to do anything and everything he pleases under all circumstances, well, then you've really got a hot argument, a ridiculous point to argue against. And you should be able to cream the guy. But when you see somebody attacking as if that, saying, well, his point is, Alapati's point is that the guru should just be completely free to do anything he wants under any circumstance, be suspicious of that, because Alapati's intelligent. Do you think he's going to say such an off-the-wall thing? Maybe he will, but be suspicious.
Bhakti Charan Maharaj was explaining how now, you know, in society, in some sectors, there's a spirit of anarchy. And this comes with a certain rationalization. The devotees feel, well, so many gurus have fallen down, and they've let us down, and now we can't trust anyone, and we'll just have to depend on ourselves. And this is also that same type of thing.
What is?
Well,
the way
it becomes extreme.
All the leaders are off now.
Yes. And or it's extreme to think, well, these people are just anarchists.
Yes.
Therefore, Bhakti Charumaj intelligently put it, that there's some tendency toward anarchy. Otherwise, you get a picture of the world where on this side, there's a batch of guys who just wants to lord it over everybody. Are we going to stand for this? No, we're not going to stand for this. They just want to beat everybody down and control everything and make everybody their slave or disciple. On the other side, you got these people. We're not going to put up with them either. What do they want? They want to tear down everything. They're against institutions. They're against order. They just want everybody to do their own thing. Are we going to put up with this? No. But is there anybody either on that side or that side? Probably not. Or maybe there's two or three here, two or three there. But there are all sorts of positions in the middle. People who think that because of this, we're going too far this way and we need to do this. because of this, we have to address that. That's where you get into reasonable discussion and argument on fair terms. Otherwise, the anarchists want that, the reformers want that. The anti-structuralists, remember, Europeans? The anti-structuralists. There was a group of people who were supposedly anti-structuralists. Anytime you tried to do something that would help create order in the society, the anti-structuralists would be against it because they were against all structure. Completely ridiculous position. There was no such animal as an anti-structuralist. It was a straw man. But as soon as you said that, yeah, we can't tolerate people who just want to tear everything down, of course, everyone agrees with you. But if you had to deal with what the man's position actually was, it's a different story. It's an easy win. Attack what he didn't really say.
It seems that the scriptures sometimes put things in such an extreme and extrapolating
really?
Way. For example, there is a statement which comes somewhat close to the Vaishnava Journal statement, which is that there is no possibility of friendship on the Kanishtha stage.
There's no possibility of friendship on the Kanishtha stage.
Friendship is possible at least on Madame.
Yeah, because what does Kanishtha stage mean? It means he doesn't make friends with devotees. By definition. It's not an exaggeration. That's the definition of Kanishtha. He doesn't know how to make friends. And if he is making friends, then by definition, he's rising above the Kanishtha stage.
Well, then it's a question of definition.
That's right.
Another example is in Bhagavad Gita, the divine and the demoniac.
That's not an exaggeration. I dealt with that the other day in the class, right? You're the one who brought it up. It's not exaggeration at all. It's analysis. There's also a difference between straw man just presenting something that's not their position and presenting it in strong words. Sometimes strong words are the only way to get across what it is. To say something's abominable is not necessarily to misstate the position. This person's advocating murder. He thinks that children in the womb should be killed, and that's murder. That's not straw man, that's just a strong point. Because that is what the person's advocating. The children in the womb should be killed. Under certain circumstances.
It's a fine line, yes.
It's not a fine line. One is understanding the argument and dealing with it. That's communism. Maybe it is communism. Maybe it's actually what Karl Marx said. Or else it's just that the person wants to liberalize things a little bit and you're just saying he's a pinko. And has no relationship with Karl Marx or Lenin or Russia or anything. Need not be a fine line. There may be a place, in other words, every line, there's a point where you reach a line someplace. But most of the stuff's way over here, way over there. Vishnumurti Prabhu.
You're saying that it's just a straight argument, and then you take it and you bend it.
Right.
So you can also have a bend argument, and you take it and you straighten it up, in regards to murder in the womb, and making so many flowery words that abortion is acceptable.
That's a different sort of thing. That's a different sort of thing.
Is that also a sort of argument? And if someone presents something very flowery.
Yeah, that's also a kind of way of arguing. We discussed that originally, emotionally toned words or detoned words. You talk about like population control, for example. That's something every sane person ought to agree with until you find out that it means killing off the Jews and gypsies, sending them to death camps. Internal security, something we're all in favor of. So you find out that it means that anyone who's Japanese in America is going to be sent to a detention camp. Because he might be befriending the enemy. So words can disguise your meaning. That's another point. Watch out for words. What does it mean? When you say democracy, what do you mean? When you say reform, what do you mean? When you say standing up for principles. Which principles do you mean, and how do you stand up for them?
Right. Wouldn't it be true to say that emotionally toned words is another form of the straw man argument? It's a little different form, but it's because one may, changing the words, one may exaggerate the position.
Yeah, they can be related in that way.
Yeah.
Straw man particularly means when you actually distort the basic points that are being made. But yes, you can work your way over there with just by messing around with words, yes. You can also create circular arguments with words. Someone, I'm for abortion, and the other man's against abortion. The man who's against it says, how can you advocate murder? But really, whether or not abortion is murder is what we're discussing. So it becomes a circular argument. I'm against abortion because it's murder. But if the topic of the discussion is abortion moral or not? Is the child in the womb a living being or not? Then just to say, well, it's murder, is circular. It's true because it's true. Or it's bad because it's bad. There's no reason. Okay? Very clear in everyone's mind what the straw man argument is? I think so. And does it go on a lot? Can you think of arguments that you've seen of this species lately? You'll see more of them. They come up every day. It's very common. Non-devotees will use them against us all the time. You Hare Krishnas are just saying this, or you're just saying that. You're in favor of this, you're in favor of that. That's not our position. But then watch out for this one, where they extend your position and then you defend the extension. They get you hot under the collar, so much so that although you started with a perfectly reasonable argument, they just got heavier and heavier and heavier, and pretty soon they've got you defending what you didn't start out saying. Familiar? It is not, it is too. Well, if you... In fact, I'd go so far as saying this. Well, then I'd go so far as saying that. And pretty soon you're way out there, defending out on a limb, defending something that's indefensible. When really you had a good, strong, solid argument you should have stuck to and won on. Watch out for that one. That was there as a trap? Yes. Don't let your opposer get you so carried away. This also relates to a point we made early on. You have to listen. If you're going to catch them distorting your argument, you have to listen so that you hear when he does it right away. If you're not listening, you're just thinking of what you're going to say next. He's going to misquote you or distort you. You're not even going to know it.
That is important also. Even if the argument gets into strong words, you always have to keep a cool head.
Yes. Keep a cool brain.
Maharaj, I feel that one argument we get a lot, and I wonder whether it is actually a straw man argument or not.
Okay.
You say that if everyone in the world became vegetarians, then there would be an overpopulation of animals.
Right.
So it's a very common argument. In one sense, it's not straw man, because we would like everyone to become vegetarian, you see. So
it's related. Extending your opponent's position by saying, well, what if everybody did this? What if everybody were to parade up and down Fifth Avenue like you people? Then where would the world be? Who'd grow food? Who'd take care of medical needs? What do you say to that?
Well, we're not intending that everyone does it at the same time, and that we're also doing these other things.
Right. What if everybody became a doctor? What if everybody went to Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, all the Catholics in New York all went at one time? It's meaningless because it's not going to happen, nor do we suggest that it happen. That everybody give up everything and just parade up and down Fifth. Nobody's doing it, somebody has to do it, so we're doing it. And why are we doing it? To encourage you to go on with your being a doctor or being a lawyer or being a businessman and do it for Krishna. You have your job. We have our job. What if everyone in the world did it? But as far as everyone in the world being a vegetarian, yes, that we actually advocate. And all the animals would overrun the place? That's a question, that's an assumption. I don't accept that. That unless man does something. How do you know? Unless man is there, the animals will overrun the universe. There's so many arguments against that proposition. It's not a straw man argument. It's just a fallacious argument. It's just a weak argument. An argument that you can't support with evidence.
It's like saying war is necessary, otherwise there would be too many human beings.
Yeah, there's so many arguments against it.
This one you've got in the... you want to put hooks in the airport, the next thing you want is singing dance to determination.
Right.
Really
the same way. Here's another one, and it's good you brought it up. This is another extension. These are related to straw man arguments. They're not straw men, but they're extension. You take the person's argument and extend it. Well, you're saying this, and the next thing you'll say is this, and the next thing you'll say is that. Well, wait, and the next thing you'll want to take over the planet. Well, wait a second. I'm not saying the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. We don't need to sing and dance in your airport. We don't need to do this and this. We simply want to have our constitutional right to distribute literature in your airport. That's all. Otherwise, you could say you're flying plane. We want to land planes in Heathrow Airport. Next thing you'll be saying is you want to land them in Piccadilly. Next thing you'll know, you want to clear out all South London and make it an airport. I don't see the logic that if you let me distribute books, you have to let me eat my prasadam here in the terminal and hold my Sunday love feast here and do this and do that. I just don't accept that. I don't accept that if I let you get married, it means I have to let you have 1,000 wives. That if I have one child, it means that if it's all right for me to have one, it's all right for me to have 10,000. That if I'm asking, can I please have a bite of food, that it means I want to eat every okra plant in the world. It's just not what I'm asking. It's not my point. It's not my argument. We have 5 people and they want to distribute books 3 times a week in your airport. Now, really? Let's talk about the issues. Let's not talk about a fairyland in which the Hare Krishnas are going to be roaming around
one thing leads to another, and before long you'll be doing all this.
Well, if one thing leads to another thing, when it leads to something that's not reasonable, we'll talk about it. But this is a perfectly reasonable request. And it's not legitimate for you to deny it on the grounds of what we might ask for sometime in the future. If we do it, we'll talk about it. If we come asking for something unreasonable, we'll talk about it then. But right now, our simple request is, we have 5 people, they want to distribute books in your airport. We did a traffic study, it's not going to interfere with the passengers, this, that, and the other thing. Let's keep in mind what we're talking about, Mr. Smith. Okay? If we ask to have 500 guys come into your airport and distribute books 24 hours a day, we'll have a different discussion about that. Right now we're talking about these 5 men, 3 times a week in your airport. Let's talk about that. Simple. Don't let them extend your argument. Don't let them distort it. Don't let them extend it. Don't let them twist it. Don't let them say, well, if you say this, then...